and members. Within a year, 200,000 APL members were operating in 1,000 communities. In Chicago, a flying squad of League members and police trailed, harassed, and beat members of the International Workers of the World. In Arizona, League members and vigilantes locked 1,200 IWW members and their collaborators into boxcars and left them on a siding in the desert across the state line in New Mexico. In Rockford, Illinois, the Army asked the League for help in gaining confessions from 21 black soldiers accused of assaulting white women. Throughout the country, the League's American Vigilance Patrol targeted seditious street oratory, sometimes calling upon the police to arrest speakers for disorderly conduct, sometimes acting more directly. And everywhere the League spied on neighbors, investigated slackers and food hoarders, demanded to know why people didn't buy, or didn't buy more, Liberty Bonds. States outlawed the teaching of German, while an Iowa politician warned that 90% of all the men and women who teach the German language are traitors. Conversations in German on the street or over the telephone became suspicious. Sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage. The Cleveland Plain Dealer stated, "What the nation demands is that treason, whether thinly veiled or quite unmasked, be stamped out." Every day, the Providence Journal carried a banner warning, "Every German or Austrian in the United States, unless known by years of association, should be treated as a spy." The Illinois Bar Association declared that lawyers who defended draft resistors were unpatriotic and unprofessional. Columbia University President Nicholas Murray Butler, a national leader of the Republican Party, fired faculty critical of the government and observed, "What had been tolerable became intolerable now. What had been wrong-headedness was now sedition. What had been folly was now treason." Thousands of government posters and advertisements urged people to report to the Justice Department anyone who spreads pessimistic stories, divulges or seeks confidential military information, cries for peace, or belittles our effort to win the war. Wilson himself began speaking of the sinister intrigue in America carried on high and low by agents and dupes. Even Wilson's enemies, even the supposedly internationalist communists, distrusted foreigners. Two communist parties initially emerged in the United States, one with a membership of native-born Americans, one 90% immigrants. Judge Learned Hand, one of Simon Flexner's closest friends, later observed, "That community is already in the process of dissolution, where each man begins to eye his neighbor as a possible enemy, where nonconformity with the accepted creed, political as well as religious, becomes a mark of disaffection, where denunciation, without specification or backing, takes the place of evidence, where orthodoxy chokes freedom of dissent." But American society hardly seemed to be dissolving. In fact, it was crystallizing around a single focal point. It was more intent upon a goal than it had ever been, or might possibly ever be again. Wilson's hard line threatened dissenters with imprisonment. The federal government also took control over much of national life. The War Industries Board allocated raw materials to factories, guaranteed profits, and controlled production and prices of war materials, and, with the National War Labor Board, it set wages as well. The Railroad Administration virtually nationalized the American railroad industry. The Fuel Administration controlled fuel distribution, and to save fuel, it also instituted daylight savings time. The Food Administration, under Herbert Hoover, oversaw agricultural production, pricing, and distribution. And the government inserted itself in the psyche of America by allowing only its own voice to be heard, by both threatening dissenters with prison and shouting down everyone else. Prior to the war, Major Douglas MacArthur had written a long proposal advocating outright censorship if the nation did fight. Journalist Arthur Bullard, who was close to Wilson confidant Colonel Edward House, argued for another approach. Congress's rejection of censorship settled the argument in Bullard's favor. Bullard had written from Europe about the war for Outlook, Century, and Harper's Weekly. He pointed out that Britain was censoring the press and had misled the British people, undermining trust in the government and support for the war. He urged using facts only. But he had no particular affection for truth per se, only for effectiveness. Truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. There is nothing in experience to tell us that one is always preferable to the other. There are lifeless truths and vital lies. The force of an idea lies in its inspirational value. It matters very little if it is true or false. Then, probably at the request of House, Walter Lippmann wrote Wilson a memo on creating a publicity bureau on April 12, 1917, a week after America declared war. One outgrowth of the progressive era, of the emergence of experts in many fields, was the conviction that an elite knew best. Typically, Lippmann later called society too big, too complex for the average person to comprehend, since most citizens were mentally children or barbarians. Self-determination is only one of the many interests of a human personality. Lippmann urged that self-rule be subordinated to order, rights, and prosperity. The day after receiving the memo, Wilson issued Executive Order 2594, creating the Committee on Public Information, the CPI, and named George Creel its head. Creel was passionate, intense, handsome, and wild. Once, years after the war and well into middle age, he literally climbed onto a chandelier in a ballroom and swung from it. He intended to create one white-hot mass with fraternity, devotion, courage, and deathless determination. To do so, Creel used tens of thousands of press releases and feature stories that were routinely run unedited by newspapers. And those same publications instituted a self-censorship. Editors would print nothing that they thought might hurt morale. Creel also created a force of 4 Minutemen. Their number ultimately exceeded 100,000, who gave brief speeches before the start of meetings, movies, vaudeville shows, and entertainment of all kinds. Bourne sadly observed, "All this intellectual cohesion, herd instinct, which seemed abroad so hysterical and so servile, comes to us here in highly rational terms." Creel began intending to report only facts, if carefully selected ones, and conducting only a positive campaign, avoiding the use of fear as a tool. But this soon changed. The new attitude was embodied in a declaration by one of Creel's writers that, "Inscribed in our banner, even above the legend Truth, is the noblest of all mottos, we serve." They served a cause. One poster designed to sell Liberty Bonds warned, "I am public opinion. All men fear me. If you have the money to buy and do not buy, I will make this no man's land for you." Another CPI poster asked, "Have you met this Kaiserite? You find him in hotel lobbies, smoking compartments, clubs, offices, even homes. He is a scandal monger of the most dangerous type. He repeats all the rumors, criticism, and lies he hears about our country's part in the war. He's very plausible. People like that. Through their vanity or curiosity or treason, they are helping German propagandists sow the seeds of discontent." Creel demanded 100% Americanism and planned for every printed bullet to reach its mark. Simultaneously, he told the 4 Minutemen that fear was an important element to be bred in the civilian population. It is difficult to unite a people by talking only on the highest ethical plane. To fight for an ideal, perhaps, must be coupled with thoughts of self-preservation. Liberty Sings, weekly community events, spread from Philadelphia across the country. Children's choruses, barbershop quartets, church choirs, all performed patriotic songs while the audiences sang along. At each gathering, a 4-Minute Man began the ceremonies with a speech. Songs that might hurt morale were prohibited. Raymond Fosdick, a student of Wilson's at Princeton and board member, and later president of the Rockefeller Foundation, headed the Commission on Training Camp Activities. This commission banned such songs as I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now, and venomous parodies such as Who Paid the Rent for Mrs. Rip Van Winkle While Mr. Rip Van Winkle Was Away, along with questionable jokes and other jokes, which, while apparently harmless, have a hidden sting, which leave the poison of discontent and worry and anxiety in the minds of the soldiers and cause them to fret about home. The songs and jokes were the culmination of letter-writing propaganda instigated by the Huns, in which they told lying tales to the men of alleged conditions of suffering at home. And Wilson gave no quarter. To open a Liberty loan drive, Wilson demanded force. Force to the utmost. Force without stint or limit. The righteous and triumphant force which shall make right the law of the world and cast every selfish dominion down in the dust. That force would ultimately, if indirectly, intensify the attack of influenza and undermine the social fabric. A softer path that Wilson also tried to lead the nation down would mitigate, but only somewhat, the damage. The softer path meant the American Red Cross. If the American Protective League mobilized citizens, nearly all of them men, to spy upon and attack anyone who criticized the war, the American Red Cross mobilized citizens, nearly all of them women, in more productive ways. The International Red Cross had been founded in 1863 with its focus on war, on the decent treatment of prisoners as set forth in the first Geneva Convention. In 1881, Clara Barton founded the American Red Cross, and the next year the United States accepted the guidelines of the convention. By World War I, all the combatants were members of the International Red Cross, but each national unit was fully independent. The American Red Cross was a quasi-public institution whose titular president was, and is, the President of the United States. Officially chartered by Congress to serve the nation in times of emergency, the American Red Cross grew even closer to the government during the war. The chairman of its central committee was Wilson's presidential predecessor, William Howard Taft, and Wilson had appointed its entire War Council, the real ruling body of the organization. As soon as the United States entered World War I, the American Red Cross declared that it would exert itself in any way which might aid our allies. The organization seeks in this great world emergency to do nothing more and nothing less than to coordinate the generosity and the effort of our people toward achieving a supreme aim. There was no more patriotic organization. It had full responsibility for supplying nurses, tens of thousands of them, to the military. It organized 50 base hospitals in France. It equipped several railroad cars as specialized laboratories in case of disease outbreaks, but reserving them for use only by the military, not by civilians, and stationed them so that one may be delivered at any point in the country within 24 hours. The Rockefeller Institute also outfitted railroad cars as state-of-the-art laboratories and placed them around the country. It cared for civilians injured or made homeless after several explosions in munitions factories. But its most important role had nothing to do with medicine or disasters. Its most important function was to bind the nation together, for Wilson used it to reach into every community in the country. Nor did the Red Cross waste the opportunity to increase its presence in American life. It had already made a reputation in several disasters. The Johnstown flood in 1889, when a dam broke and water smashed down upon the Pennsylvania city like a hammer, killing 2,500 people. The San Francisco earthquake in 1906. Major floods on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers in 1912. It had also served American troops in the Spanish-American War and during the insurrection in the Philippines that followed. Still, the American Red Cross began the Great War with only 107 local chapters. It finished with 3,864 chapters. It reached into the largest cities and into the smallest villages. It made clear that to participate in Red Cross activities was to join the Great Crusade for Civilization, and especially for American civilization. And it used subtlety and social pressure to all but compel participation. It identified the most prominent and influential man in a city, a person whom others could refuse only with difficulty, and asked him to chair the local Red Cross chapter. It appealed to him, told him how important he was to the war effort, how needed he was. Almost invariably, he agreed. And it asked the leading hostess, the leader of society in cities, in Philadelphia, Mrs. J. Willis Martin, who started the nation's first garden club and whose family and husband's family were as established as any on the main line, or whatever passed for society in small towns. In Haskell County, Mrs. Loring Minor, whose father was the largest landowner in southwest Kansas, to chair a woman's auxiliary. In 1918, the Red Cross counted 30 million Americans, out of a total population of 105 million, as active supporters. 8 million Americans, nearly 8% of the entire population, served as production workers in local chapters. The Red Cross had more volunteers in World War I than in World War II, despite a 30% increase in the nation's population. Women made up nearly all this enormous volunteer workforce, and they might as well have worked in factories. Each chapter received a production quota, and each chapter produced that quota. They produced millions of sweaters, millions of blankets, millions of socks. They made furniture. They did everything requested of them, and they did it well. When the Federal Food Administration said that pits from peaches, prunes, dates, plums, apricots, olives, and cherries were needed to make carbon for gas masks, newspapers reported, "Confectioners and restaurants in various cities have begun to serve nuts and fruit at cost in order to turn in the pits and shells, a patriotic service. Every American man, woman, or child who has a relative or friend in the Army should consider it a matter of personal obligation to provide enough carbon-making material for his gas mask." And so Red Cross chapters throughout the country collected thousands of tons of fruit pits. So many they were told, finally, to stop. As William Maxwell, a novelist and New Yorker editor who grew up in Lincoln, Illinois, recalled, "Mother would go down to roll bandages for the soldiers. She put something like a dish towel on her head with a red cross on the front and wore white. And in school we saved prune pits which were supposed to be turned into gas masks so that the town was aware of the war effort. At all events, there was an active sense of taking part in the war." The war was absorbing all of the nation. The draft, originally limited to men aged 21 to 30, was soon extended to men aged 18 to 45. Even with the expanded base, the government declared that all men in that age group would be called within a year. All men, the government said. The Army would require as well at least 100,000 officers. The Student Army Training Corps was to provide many of that number. It would admit men by voluntary induction, placing them on active duty immediately. In May 1918, Secretary of War Newton Baker wrote the presidents of all institutions of collegiate grade, from Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to the North Pacific College of Dentistry in Portland, Oregon. He did not ask for cooperation, much less permission. He simply stated, "Military instruction under officers and non-commissioned officers of the Army will be provided in every institution of college grade which enroll 100 or more male students. All students over the age of 18 will be encouraged to enlist. The commanding officer will enforce military discipline." In August 1918, an underling followed Baker's letter with a memo to college administrators, stating that the war would likely necessitate the mobilization of all physically fit registrants under 21 within 10 months from this date. The student, by voluntary induction, becomes a soldier in the United States Army, uniformed, subject to military discipline and with the pay of a private, on full active duty. Upon being activated, nearly all would be sent to the front. 20-year-olds would get only 3 months training before activation, with younger men getting only a few months more. In view of the comparatively short time during which most of the student soldiers will remain in college and the exacting military duties awaiting them, academic instruction must necessarily be modified along the lines of direct military value. Therefore, the teaching of academic courses was to end, to be replaced by military training. Military officers were to take virtual command of each college in the country. High schools were urged to intensify their instruction so that young men 17 and 18 years old may be qualified to enter college as quickly as possible. The full engagement of the nation had begun the instant Wilson had chosen war. Initially, the American Expeditionary Force in Europe was just that, a small force numbering little more than a skirmish line. But the American army was massing, and the forging of all the nation into a weapon was approaching completion. That process would jam millions of young men into extraordinarily tight quarters in barracks built for far fewer. It would bring millions of workers into factories and cities where there was no housing, where men and women not only shared rooms but beds, where they not only shared beds but shared beds in shifts, where one shift of workers came home, if their room could be called a home, and climbed into a bed just vacated by others leaving to go to work, where they breathed the same air, drank from the same cups, used the same knives and forks. That process also meant that through both intimidation and voluntary cooperation, despite a stated disregard for truth, the government controlled the flow of information. The full engagement of the nation would thus provide the great sausage machine with more than one way to grind a body up. It would grind away with the icy neutrality that technology and nature share, and it would not limit itself to the usual cannon fodder. Chapter 10. While America still remained neutral, William Welch, then president of the National Academy of Sciences, and his colleagues watched as their European counterparts tried to perfect killing devices. Technology has always mattered in war, but this was the first truly scientific war. The first war that matched engineers and their abilities to build not just artillery, but submarines and airplanes and tanks. The first war that matched laboratories of chemists and physiologists devising or trying to counteract the most lethal poison gas. Technology, like nature, always exhibits the ice of neutrality, however heated its effect. Some even saw the war itself as a magnificent laboratory in which to test and improve not just the hard sciences, but theories of crowd behavior, of scientific management of the means of production, of what was thought of as the new science of public relations. The National Academy had itself been created during the Civil War to advise the government on science, but it did not direct or coordinate scientific research on war technologies. No American institution did. In 1915, astronomer George Hale began urging Welch and others in the NAS to take the lead in creating such an institution. He convinced them, and in April 1916, Welch wrote Wilson, "The Academy now considers it to be its plain duty, in case of war or preparation for war, to volunteer its assistance and secure the enlistment of its members for any services we can offer." Wilson had been a graduate student at the Hopkins when Welch had first arrived there and immediately invited him, Hale, and a few others to the White House. There they proposed to establish a National Research Council to direct all war-related scientific work. But they needed the president to formally request its creation. Wilson immediately agreed, although he insisted the move remain confidential. He wanted confidentiality because any preparation for war set off debate, and Wilson was about to use all the political capital he cared to in order to create the Council of National Defense, which was to lay plans for what would become, After the country entered the war, the virtual government takeover of the production and distribution of economic resources. The Council's membership was comprised of 6 cabinet secretaries, including the secretaries of war and the Navy, and 7 men outside the government. Ironically, considering Wilson's intense Christianity, 3 of the 7 were Jews. Samuel Gompers, head of the American Federation of Labor, Bernard Baruch, the financier, and Julius Rosenwald, head of Sears. Almost simultaneously, Wilson appointed Brandeis to the Supreme Court. All this marked the first significant representation of Jews in government. But Wilson's silent approval was enough. Welch, Hale, and the others formed their new organization, bringing in respected scientists in several fields. Scientists who asked other colleagues to conduct specific pieces of research. Research that fitted in with other pieces. Research that together had potential applications. And medicine, too, had become a weapon of war. By then, a kind of organizational chart had developed in American scientific medicine. This chart, of course, did not exist in any formal sense, but it was real. At the top sat Welch, fully the impresario, capable of changing the lives of those upon whom his glance lingered, capable as well of directing great sums of money to an institution with a nod. Only he held such power in American science, and no one else has held such power since. On the rung below him were a handful of contemporaries, men who had fought beside him to change medicine in the United States, and who had well-deserved reputations. Perhaps Victor Vaughan ranked second to him as a builder of institutions. He had created a solid one at Michigan and been the single most important voice outside the Hopkins demanding reform of medical education. In surgery, the brothers Charles and William Mayo were giants and immensely important allies in forcing change. In the laboratory, Theobald Smith inspired. In public health, Herman Biggs had made the New York City Department of Health probably the best municipal health department in the world, and he had just taken over the state health department, while in Providence, Rhode Island, Charles Chapin had applied the most rigorous science to public health questions and reached conclusions that were revolutionizing public health practices. And in the U.S. Army, Surgeon General William Gorgas also had developed an international reputation, continuing and expanding upon George Sternberg's tradition. Both the National Research Council and the Council of National Defense had medical committees that were controlled by Welch himself, Gorgas, Vaughan, and the Mayo brothers, all 5 of whom had already served as president of the American Medical Association. But conspicuous by his absence was Rupert Blue, then the civilian surgeon general and head of the U.S. Public Health Service, USPHS. Welch and his colleagues so doubted his abilities and judgment that they not only blocked him from serving on the committees, but would not allow him even to name his own representative to them. Instead, they picked a USPHS scientist they trusted. It was not a good sign that the head of the Public Health Service was so little regarded. From the beginning of their planning, these men focused on the biggest killer in war. Not combat, but epidemic disease. Throughout the wars in history, more soldiers had often died of disease than in battle or of their wounds. And epidemic disease had routinely spread from armies to civilian populations. This was true not just in ancient times or in the American Civil War, in which 2 men died from disease for every battle-related death. Counting both sides, 185,000 troops died in combat or of their wounds, while 373,000 died of disease. More soldiers had died of disease than combat even in the wars fought since scientists had adopted the germ theory and modern public health measures. In the Boer War that raged from 1899 to 1902 between Britain and the white settlers of South Africa, 10 British troops died of disease for each combat-related death. The British also put nearly a quarter of the Boer population in concentration camps, where 26,370 women and children died. In the Spanish-American War in 1898, 6 American soldiers died of disease, nearly all of them from typhoid, for every one killed in battle or who died of his wounds. The Spanish-American War deaths especially were entirely unnecessary. The army had expanded in a matter of months from 28,000 to 275,000, and Congress had appropriated $50 million for the military, but not a penny went to the Army Medical Department. As a result, a camp of 60,000 soldiers at Chickamauga had not a single microscope. Nor was Army Surgeon General Sternberg given any authority. Military engineers and line officers directly rejected his angry protests about a dangerously unsanitary camp design and water supply. Their stubbornness killed roughly 5,000 American young men. Other diseases could be equally dangerous. When even normally mild diseases such as whooping cough, chickenpox, and mumps invade a virgin human population, a population not previously exposed to them, they often kill in large numbers, and young adults are especially vulnerable. In the Franco-Prussian War in 1871, for example, measles killed 40% of those who fell ill during the siege of Paris, and a measles epidemic erupted in the U.S. Army in 1911, killing 5% of all the men who caught the disease. Those facts were of deep concern to Welch, Vaughn, Gorgas, and the others. They committed themselves to ensuring that the best medical science be available to the military. Welch, 67 years old, short, obese, and out of breath, put a uniform on, devoted much time to army business, and took a desk in Gorgas's personal office that he used whenever in Washington. Vaughn, 65 years old and equally obese at 275 pounds, put a uniform on and became head of the Army's Division of Communicable Disease. Flexner, at age 54, put a uniform on. Gorgas had them all commissioned majors, the highest rank then allowed. Regulations were changed, and they all later became colonels. They thought not only about caring for soldiers wounded in combat. They thought not only about finding a source for digitalis, which was imported from Germany. Boy Scouts gathered foxglove in Oregon, and tests found it produced a suitable drug. Or surgical needles. These, too, were all imported, so they set up a U.S. factory to produce them. Or discovering the most efficient way to disinfect huge amounts of laundry. They asked Chapin to look into this. They thought about epidemic disease. The single man who had the chief responsibility for the performance of military medicine was Surgeon General of the Army William Crawford Gorgas. The Army gave him little authority with which to work, not much more than Sternberg had had. But he was a man able to accomplish much in the face of not only benign neglect, but outright opposition from those above him. Naturally optimistic and cheerful, devout, son of a Confederate officer who became president of the University of Alabama, Gorgas took up medicine ironically in pursuit of another aim, a military career. After he failed to get an appointment to West Point, it seemed his only way into the Army, and he took it despite his father's bitter opposition. He soon became entirely comfortable in medicine and preferred to be addressed as doctor rather than by rank, even as he rose to general. He loved learning and set aside a fixed amount of minutes each day for reading, rotating his attention among fiction, science, and classical literature. Gorgas had a distinct softness around his eyes that made him appear gentle, and he treated virtually everyone with whom he came into contact with dignity. His appearance and manner belied, however, his intensity, determination, focus, and occasional ferocity. In the midst of crisis or obstacles, his public equanimity made him a center of calm, the kind that calmed and gave confidence to others. But in private, after encountering obtuseness, if not outright stupidity, in his superiors, he slammed drawers, hurled inkwells, and stormed out of his office muttering threats to quit. Like Sternberg, he spent much of his early career at frontier posts in the West, although he also took Welch's course at Bellevue. Unlike Sternberg, he did not personally do any significant laboratory research. But he was every bit as tenacious, every bit as disciplined. Two experiences epitomized both his abilities and his determination to do his job. The first came in Havana after the Spanish-American War. He did not belong to Walter Reed's team investigating yellow fever. Their work, in fact, did not convince him that the mosquito carried the disease. Nonetheless, he was given the task of killing mosquitoes in Havana. He succeeded in this task, despite doubting its usefulness, so well that in 1902, yellow fever deaths there fell to zero. Zero. And malaria deaths fell by 75%. The results convinced him that the mosquito hypothesis was correct. An even more significant triumph came when he later took charge of clearing yellow fever from the construction sites along the Panama Canal. In this case, his superiors rejected the mosquito hypothesis, gave him the barest minimum of resources, and tried to undermine his authority, his effort, and him personally, at one point demanding that he be replaced. He persisted and succeeded, partly through his intelligence and insight into the problems disease presented, partly through his ability to maneuver bureaucratically. In the process, he also earned a reputation as an international expert on public health and sanitation. He became Surgeon General of the Army in 1914 and immediately began massaging congressmen and senators for money and authority to prepare in case the country went to war. He wanted no repeat of Sternberg's Spanish-American experience. Believing his work done, in 1917 he submitted his resignation to join a Rockefeller-sponsored international health project. When the United States entered the war, he withdrew his resignation. Then, 63 years old, white-haired, with a handlebar mustache, and thin. As a boy, he had been almost fragile, and he remained thin despite an appetite for food that rivaled Welch's. He took as his first task surrounding himself with the best possible people, while simultaneously trying to inject his and their influence into Army planning. His War Department seniors did not consult his department on the sites for its several dozen new cantonments, but Army engineers did pay close attention to the medical department and the actual design of the training camps. They, too, wanted no repeat of the mistakes that had killed thousands of soldiers in 1898. But only in one other area did the Army Medical Department receive even a hearing from War Department leadership. That was its massive campaign against venereal disease, a campaign supported strongly by a political union of progressives, many of whom believed in perfecting secular society, and from Christian moralists. The same political odd couple would soon unite to enact prohibition. Gorgas's office recognized to what extremes the sexual moralist can go. How unpractical, how intolerant, how extravagant, even how unreasoning, if not scientifically dishonest, he can be. But it also knew that one-third of all work days lost to illness in the Army were caused by venereal disease. That loss, the military would not tolerate. The medical corps told enlisted men to masturbate instead of using prostitutes. It produced posters with such slogans as, "A soldier who gets a dose is a traitor." It examined enlisted men twice a month for venereal disease, required any man infected to identify the person with whom or the building in which they had had sex, docked the pay of soldiers or sailors sick with venereal disease, and also made them subject to court-martial. With support from the most senior political leadership, the military by law prohibited prostitution and the sale of alcohol within 5 miles of any base. And the military had 70 bases with 10,000 or more soldiers or sailors scattered around the country. The health boards of 27 states passed regulations allowing detention of people suffering venereal infection until they are no longer a danger to the community. 80 red light districts were shut down. Even New Orleans had to close down its legendary Storyville, where prostitution was legal, where Buddy Bolden, Jelly Roll Morton, Louis Armstrong, and others had invented jazz in the whorehouses. And New Orleans Mayor Martin Berman was no reformer. He headed a political machine so tight it was called simply the Ring. But if Gorgas had the power to act decisively on venereal disease, if engineers listened to his sanitary experts in designing water supplies, the army paid him little heed on anything else. On no subject where he had only science behind him, science without political weight, could he get even a hearing from army superiors. Even when an American researcher developed an antitoxin for gangrene, Gorgas could not convince them to fund testing at the front. So Welch arranged for the Rockefeller Institute to pay the expenses of a team of investigators to go to Europe, and for the British Army to test the antitoxin in British hospitals. It worked, although not perfectly. In many ways, then, Gorgas, Welch, Vaughn, and their colleagues operated as a team independent of the Army. But they could not operate independently in regard to epidemic disease, and they could not operate either independently or alone as camps filled with hundreds of thousands, in fact, millions of young men. When the war began, there were 140,000 physicians in the United States. Only 776 of them were serving in the Army or Navy. The military needed tens of thousands of physicians, and it needed them immediately. It would make no exceptions for scientists. Most would volunteer anyway. Most wanted to participate in this great crusade. Welch and Vaughn joined the military, despite their being 100 pounds overweight and past the regular Army's mandatory retirement age. And they were not alone. Flexner joined at age 54. Flexner's protege, Paul Lewis at Penn, Milton Rosenau at Harvard, and Eugene Opie at Washington University joined. All around the country, laboratory scientists were joining. And to avoid losing scientists piecemeal either as volunteers or to the draft, Flexner suggested to Welch that the entire Rockefeller Institute be incorporated into the Army. Welch carried the idea to Gorgas, and Gorgas's deputy wired Flexner, "Unit will be arranged as you desire." And so the Rockefeller Institute became Army Auxiliary Laboratory No. 1. There would be no Auxiliary Laboratory No. 2. Men in uniforms marched down laboratory and hospital corridors. An Army adjutant commanded the technicians and janitors, maintained Army discipline among them, and drilled them on parade on York Avenue. Lunch became mess. A mobile hospital unit on wheels with buildings, wards, labs, laundry, and kitchen was rolled into the front yard of the Institute from 64th to 66th Streets to treat soldiers with intractable wounds. Sergeants saluted scientists who, except for two Canadians who became privates, received officer rank. This was no mere cosmetic change to allow life to go on as usual. During the Vietnam War, many physician scientists joined the public health service to avoid the draft. But their work did go on as usual. They were assigned to the National Institutes of Health, which enjoyed some of its most productive years in history because of the influx of talent. At Rockefeller, the fiber of the work was rewoven. Nearly all research shifted to something war-related or to instruction. Alexis Carrel, a Nobel laureate in 1912 who pioneered the surgical reattachment of limbs and organ transplantation as well as tissue culture, he kept part of a chicken heart alive for 32 years, taught surgical techniques to hundreds of newly militarized physicians. Others taught bacteriology. A biochemist studied poison gas. Another chemist explored ways to get more acetone from starch, which could be used both in making explosives and to stiffen the fabric that covered airplane wings. Peyton Rouse, who had already done the work that would later, decades later, win him a Nobel Prize, redirected his work to preserving blood. He developed a method, still in use, that led to the first blood banks being established at the front in 1917. The war also consumed the supply of practicing physicians. Gorgas, Welch, and Vaughn had already laid plans for this. In December 1916, they had, through the Council of National Defense, asked state medical associations to secretly grade physicians. Roughly half of all practicing physicians were judged incompetent to serve. So when America did enter the war, the military first examined every male graduate of medical school in 1914, 1915, and 1916, seeking, as Vaughn said, the best from these classes. This would supply approximately 10,000 doctors. Many of the best medical schools also sent much of their faculty to France, where the schools functioned as intact units, staffing and unofficially lending their names to entire military hospitals. Yet these moves could not begin to satisfy the need. By the time the armistice was signed, 38,000 physicians would be serving in the military, at least half of all those under age 45 considered fit for service. The military, and especially the Army, did not stop there. In April 1917, the Army had 58 dentists. In November 1918, it had 5,654. And the military needed nurses. There were too few nurses. Nursing had, like medicine, changed radically in the late 19th century. It, too, had become scientific. But changes in nursing involved factors that went beyond the purely scientific. They involved status, power, and the role of women. Nursing was one of the few fields that gave women opportunity and status, and that they controlled. While Welch and his colleagues were revolutionizing American medicine, Jane Delano, Lavinia Dock, both of whom were students in Bellevue's nursing program while Welch was exposing medical students there to new realities, and others were doing the same to nursing. But they fought not with an entrenched old guard in their own profession so much as with physicians. Sometimes physicians, threatened by intelligent and educated nurses, waged a virtual guerrilla war. In some hospitals, physicians replaced labels on drug bottles with numbers so nurses could not question a prescription. In 1912, before becoming Surgeon General, Gorgas had anticipated that if war ever came, the Army would need vast numbers of nurses, many more than would likely be available. He believed, however, that not all of them would have to be fully trained. He wanted to create a corps of practical nurses who lacked the education and training of graduate nurses. Others were also advancing this idea, but they were all men. The women who ran nursing would have none of it. Jane Delano had taught nursing and had headed the Army Nurse Corps. Proud and intelligent as well as tough, driven and authoritarian, she had then just left the Army to establish the Red Cross nursing program, and the Red Cross had all responsibility for supplying nurses to the Army, evaluating, recruiting, and often assigning them. She rejected Gorgas's plan, telling her colleagues it seriously threatened the status of professional nursing and warning, "Our nursing service would be of no avail with these groups of women unrelated to us, organized by physicians, taught by physicians, serving under their guidance." She told the Red Cross bluntly that if this plan were put through, I should at once sever my connection with the Red Cross, and every member of the state and local committee would go out with me. It would seem nurses needed their status protected. In the summer of 1918, the Treasury Department informed the Secretary of War that Army nurses taken captive, unlike soldiers, were not entitled to pay while they were prisoners of war. Outrage later forced a reversal of this policy. The Red Cross and the Army surrendered to her. No training of nursing aides commenced. When the United States entered the war, it had 98,162 graduate nurses, women whose training probably exceeded that of many, if not most, doctors trained before 1910. The war sucked up nurses as it sucked up everything else. In May 1918, roughly 16,000 nurses were serving in the military. Gorgas believed that the Army alone needed 50,000. After Gorgas again pleaded with the Red Cross to carry out the plans already formulated, after learning confidential information about the desperation in combat hospitals, Delano reversed herself, supported Gorgas, and tried to convince her colleagues of the need for practical nurses. Her professional colleagues rebuffed them both. They refused to participate in organizing any large training program of such aides and agreed only to establish an army nursing school. By October 1918, this new nursing school had produced not a single fully trained nurse. The triumph of the nursing profession at large over the Red Cross and the United States Army, an army at war, was extraordinary. That the victors were women made it more extraordinary. Ironically, this triumph reflected as well a triumph of George Creel's Committee on Public Information over the truth. For Creel's propaganda machine had prevented the public from learning just how profound the need for nurses was. In the meantime, the military's appetite for doctors and nurses only grew. 4 million American men were under arms with more coming, and Gorgas was planning for 300,000 hospital beds. The number of trained medical staff he had simply could not handle that load. So the military suctioned more and more nurses and physicians into cantonments, aboard ships, into France, until it had extracted nearly all the best young physicians. Medical care for civilians deteriorated rapidly. The doctors who remained in civilian life were largely either incompetent young ones or those over 45 years of age, the vast majority of whom had been trained in the old ways of medicine. The shortage of nurses would prove even more serious. Indeed, it would prove deadly, especially in civil society. All this added kindling to the tinderbox. Still more kindling would come. Chapter 11. Wilson had demanded that the spirit of ruthless brutality enter into the very fiber of national life. To carry out that charge, Creel had wanted to create one white-hot mass, a mass driven by deathless determination. He was doing so. This was truly total war, and that totality truly included the medical profession. Creel's spirit even injected itself into Military Surgeon, a journal published by the Army for its physicians, which said, "Every single activity of this country is directed towards one single object, the winning of the war. Nothing else counts now, and nothing will count ever if we don't win it. No organization of any kind should be countenanced that has not this object in immediate view and is likely to help in the most efficient way. Thus the medical sciences are applied to war. The arts are applied in perfecting camouflage, in reviving the spirits of our soldiers by entertainment, etc." This medical journal, this journal for physicians whose goal was to save life, also declared, "The consideration of human life often becomes quite secondary. The medical officer has become more absorbed in the general than the particular, and the life and limb of the individual, while of great importance, are secondary to measures pro bono publico." And this same journal expressed its opinion of what constituted pro bono publico when it quoted approvingly advice from Major Donald McCrae, a combat veteran who said, "If any enemy wounded are found in the trench, they should be bayoneted, if sufficient prisoners for interrogation have been taken." Gorgas did not share the views of the journal's editors. When the investigator funded by Rockefeller found his gangrene antitoxin effective, he wanted to publish his results, which could help the Germans. Both Gorgas and Secretary of War Newton Baker agreed that he should do so, and he did. Welch told Flexner, "I was very glad that both the Secretary and Surgeon General, without any hesitation, took this position." But Gorgas had more important things to do than police the editors of Military Surgeon. He was focusing upon his mission, and he was pursuing it with the obsessiveness of a missionary. For Gorgas had a nightmare. The U.S. Army had exploded from a few tens of thousands of soldiers before the war to millions in a few months. Huge cantonments, each holding roughly 50,000 men, were thrown together in a matter of weeks. Hundreds of thousands of men occupied them before the camps were completed. They were jammed into those barracks that were finished, Barracks designed for far less than their number, while tens of thousands of young soldiers lived through the first winter in tents. Hospitals were the last buildings to be constructed. These circumstances not only brought huge numbers of men into this most intimate proximity, but exposed farm boys to city boys from hundreds of miles away, each of them with entirely different disease immunities and vulnerabilities. Never before in American history, and possibly never before in any country's history, had so many men been brought together in such a way. Even at the front in Europe, even with the importation there of labor from China, India, and Africa, the concentration and throwing together of men with different vulnerabilities may not have been as explosive a mix as that in American training camps. Gorgas's nightmare was of an epidemic sweeping through those camps. Given the way troops moved from camp to camp, if an outbreak of infectious disease erupted in one, it would be extraordinarily difficult to isolate that camp and keep the disease from spreading to others. Thousands, possibly tens of thousands, could die. Such an epidemic might spread to the civilian population as well. Gorgas intended to do all within his power to prevent his nightmare from becoming real. By 1917, medical science was far from helpless in the face of disease. It stood, in fact, on the banks of the River Styx. If it was able to wade into those waters and pull only a few people back from that crossing, in its laboratories lay the promise of much more. True, science had so far developed only a single one of the magic bullets envisaged by Paul Ehrlich. He and a colleague had tried 900 different chemical compounds to cure syphilis before retesting the 606th one. It was an arsenic compound. This time they made it work, curing syphilis without poisoning the patient. Named Salvarsan, it was often called just 606. But science had achieved considerable success in manipulating the immune system and in public health. Vaccines prevented a dozen diseases that devastated livestock, including anthrax and hog cholera. Investigators had also gone far beyond the first success against smallpox and were now developing vaccines to prevent a host of diseases as well as antitoxins and serums to cure them. Science had triumphed over diphtheria. Sanitary and public health measures were containing typhoid, cholera, yellow fever, and bubonic plague, and vaccines against typhoid, cholera, and plague also appeared. Antitoxin for snake bites went into production. An antiserum for dysentery was found. A tetanus antitoxin brought magical results. Before its widespread use, in 1903 in the United States, 102 people died out of every 1,000 treated for tetanus. 10 years later, universal use of the antitoxin lowered the death rate to 0 per 1,000 treated. Meningitis had been checked, if not conquered, largely by Flexner's antiserum. In 1917, an antitoxin for gangrene was developed. Although it was not nearly as effective as other antitoxins, scientists could improve it as they had improved others over time. The possibilities of manipulating the immune system to defeat infectious disease seemed to hold enormous promise. When antibiotics first appeared in the late 1930s and 1940s, they performed like magic, and much of this research was abandoned. In the early 1960s, public health officials were declaring victory over infectious disease. Now, with dozens of strains of bacteria developing resistance to drugs, with viruses gaining resistance even faster, with such diseases as tuberculosis, once considered conquered, making comebacks, investigators have returned to searching for ways to stimulate the immune system against everything from infections to cancer. At the management level, Gorgas was taking action too. He saw to it that many of the new army doctors assigned to the cantonments were trained at the Rockefeller Institute by some of the best scientists in the world. He began stockpiling huge quantities of vaccines, antitoxins, and sera. He did not rely for these products on drug manufacturers. They were unreliable and often useless. In 1917, in fact, New York State Health Commissioner Hermann Biggs tested commercial products for several diseases and found them so poor that he banned all sales from all drug manufacturers in New York State. So Gorgas assigned production to people he could rely upon. The Army Medical School would make enough typhoid vaccine for 5 million men. The Rockefeller Institute would produce sera for pneumonia, dysentery, and meningitis. The Hygienic Laboratory in Washington, which ultimately grew into the National Institutes of Health, would prepare smallpox vaccine and antitoxins for diphtheria and tetanus. He also transformed several railroad cars into the most modern laboratory facilities. The equipping of these cars was paid for not by the government, but by the Rockefeller Institute and the American Red Cross, and stationed these rolling laboratories at strategic points around the country, ready, as Flexner told Gorgas's deputy for scientific matters, Colonel Frederick Russell, to be sent to any one of the camps at which pneumonia or other epidemic disease prevails. Also, even before construction began on the cantonments, Gorgas created a special unit for the prevention of infectious disease. He assigned the very best men to it. Welch, who had already toured British and French camps and was alert to possible weak points, headed this unit, and its five other members were Flexner, Vaughn, Russell, Biggs, and Rhode Island's Charles Chapin. Each of them had international renown. They laid out precise procedures for the Army to follow to minimize the chances of an epidemic.